we talk about carbon, we talk about CO2 and all those things, but there's a lot of emissions of waste. We need to get some standards put in place with policy.
So what I'm really presenting here is a story of deep and integrated alignment from global to national policy, from national to regional, local and sectoral policies. And I would say that it's the first time in my career, certainly, that industry leaders in government have worked collaboratively in this way.
Policy change that is ensuring sustainable high growth must be inclusive, both in the process of formulating, but also in the process of implementing the actual policy. Equity and inclusiveness underpin any growth strategy that is intended to not leave anyone behind.
This is the Oblique Life Global Goals Podcast,
discussing the challenges we face to reach the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals.
But more importantly, sharing the solutions inspiring us to get there. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Oblique Life Global Goals Podcast. I'm one half of your co-host, Romy Sabaria, founder of the Oblique Life.
And I'm the other half, Ben Joseph, musician and entrepreneur. So as we have discussed in previous episodes, we all have a responsibility in saving the planet we call home. But we can't rely on good intentions alone. We need radical and effective policy to enable and implement change. According to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, regulations, policies, and legislation are indispensable to the proper function of economies and societies. I couldn't agree more. Policy can serve as a carrot to incentivize what we want more of, or a stick to curtail behavior. Finally, when they are obsolete, we can change or simply remove them.
And that is what we want to explore in this episode. Production and consumption are starting to adapt, but climate change is causing many issues. So why are we not seeing urgency from the public sector to formulate and implement braver, better, and more coordinated policy? Is the private sector too powerful? Take the oil and gas industry. In the last three decades, five major US oil companies have spent a total of at least $3.6 billion on advertisements. Robert Bruhl, a professor of environmental sociology at Brown University, found that more than $2 billion was spent lobbying Congress on climate change legislation between 2000 and 2016. He says lawmakers should investigate the oil industry the way the former Congressman Henry Waxman took on the tobacco companies in the 1990s.
So yes, we have politicians, but what about the ordinary citizen? Can we be an agent for change? At what point should we be invited or indeed knocked down the door? But also, how do we make it easier for citizens to comply? How do we ensure policy is inclusive? That whatever your nationality, gender, age, wealth, physical, or mental ability, you are not left behind. How do we make it easier for the citizen to have their voices heard? Take young people, for example. Generation X are the ones picking up the pieces left by the baby boomers. The UN Secretary General's envoy on youth stated, "Achieving sustainable development requires a generation that knows about, cares about, and takes ownership of the global development agenda." Young people will be the ones leading this agenda in the years to come. In fact, many places they already are.
Wow, Ben, that is some introduction, and we have a lot to cover in today's episode. And I guess what makes me super excited is we have three incredible guests that are going to help us explore these topics. They have all, in their various ways, been involved in different areas of policy. They're all very aware of some of the challenges we face, but I'm also looking forward to hearing some of the solutions they can share with us. Let's start and introduce our speakers for today's episode.
Yes, Rami, but before that, we're going to make a shout out to our partner, Tree Points. So if you are new to the series, you might not know, but together with Tree Points, an incredible company that is helping offset our carbon footprint, we are committing to offset 100 kilograms of CO2 for every 100 listeners that tune into the podcast. So please do get your friends, family, and colleagues to join and subscribe so we can offset as much CO2 as possible. Thank you. All right, Rami, back to you.
First and foremost, we're going to go with Douglas Morrison, Director of Operations and Future Skills at the Construction Scotland Innovation Centre. Douglas, welcome to the podcast. Welcome to Oblique Global Goals. Please, can you give a quick introduction into who you are and a bit of background on what you've been doing in and around the sustainability space?
Certainly, Romy. And can I just say it's a great pleasure to be here and thank you so much for the invitation. So I'm Douglas Morrison. I work with the Construction Scotland Innovation Centre in Scotland, United Kingdom, and I also act as a member of the Young Academy of Scotland. So the Construction Scotland Innovation Centre are Scotland's national innovation centre for the built environment, and our role is to support the mainstreaming of innovation in the construction industry, and we focus on doing that through digital transformation, accelerating industrialisation, building sustainably and changing cultures. My background is mostly in further and higher education, where I've spent the last 15 years of my career. And I joined the Innovation Centre in March of this year. So big items on our agenda are COVID, Britain's withdrawal from the European Union, and of course the climate emergency and opportunity. And you know, we have the pleasure in Scotland of hosting the COP26 conference in Glasgow in 2021, where we hope to provide a global focal point to systemic environmental change.
Thank you very much, Douglas, and I'm really excited to hear what you have to share with our audience today. Our second guest, all the way from Australia, thank you very much for joining us. Gerald Asbrook, welcome, founder at Fiero Group Australia. Do you want to give a quick introduction into who you are, what you've been doing, and what you've been doing around the sustainability space, Gerald?
I had a very good start in my same life. I had three trades and I worked hard, and I went up through a very large what's name company, which you wouldn't know about. It's what's name Penfold Wines, and they were the biggest in Oz, and they were pretty good. They were pretty progressive, and we had core teams within it that we always question things like, you know, waste of water, waste of cardboard, and we pushed it from quite young. I'm 63, so if I refer to things, I already refer back to things from about the 70s and 80s and on. So at the moment, I've been focused quite a lot on energy, and one of my favourite subjects is the movement to circular and the use of it and how you apply it on actual energy. And I'm often attacked. They say you can't refer it. I said yes, you can. You can apply it, and you'll get these unusual results that you certainly don't expect. But it's got a very good. It's always got a very good finish to it if you apply it properly. So yes, I spent my life in a trade, spent my life in a large business. Yes, I pushed myself up through the structure of that. In 1995, I basically said I've had enough of this massive corporation. They were good, but I started my own business in 1995. And I was very passionate in the field of wine. So I went into that, and I helped my friends and helped actually build a large young business around the manufacturing of wine. And it gave me a very broad viewpoint on all the aspects, which is water, you know, gas, refrigeration, everything. So we've applied that, and I've settled back into right now it's more about our energy and waste and what we could possibly do. So, yes, I look forward to having a talk with you all and really just explaining what I've been through, where I am, and where I'm actually going with it. So, yes, let's. Hopefully we can get through it and we can talk it through.
No, thank you very much, Gerald, and a really pleasure to have you on the podcast with us today. And our last guest, Sonwabise Sabata from South Africa, Johannesburg, Senior Manager for Global Policy and Government Affairs at Global Citizen. Salma Beza, do you want to give a quick and brief introduction into yourself, what you've been up to and what you're doing?
Yeah, sure. Thank you so much for the introduction. And thank you for having us, me and Global Citizen, on this podcast. As you rightfully say, I am a Senior Manager for Global Policy and Government Affairs at Global Citizen. Global Citizen is an advocacy NGO that whose mandate is clearly around ending extreme poverty by 2030. We do this primarily by combining policy and POP in order to challenge world leaders to drive active citizens to take actions that are leading us towards achieving the sustainable development goals. We've been in South Africa now since 2018, in what culminated to be a really, really successful global festival called the Mandela 100 Festival, which all of you may know us from.
Thank you for that, Salma Beza.
That's Ben's appreciation. He absolutely loves it. And thank you for that little interlude, Ben. I'm really excited. Let's get the conversation. Let's get the questions going. Ben, why don't you jump in with the first question?
So, Douglas, consumerism is multi-layered, but why is it taking so long to implement better and effective policy? Looking at two of the sectors that have been driving this, construction and energy, can you share what you think are the main reasons?
Yeah, certainly. So, I mean, we have a culture of procuring for best value. And unfortunately, that often means that we procure for the cheapest solution. And really, this happens at both an individual consumer level, but also at the level of government and public sector investment. And to offer context for the construction industry, public sector spending represents between 40 and 50%. Of investment in construction activity in Scotland every year. Now, in Scotland, we are fortunate, and we have some pretty progressive policies that are being implemented to really push our ambition of a net zero built environment, and that's welcome. Our circular economy bill is a good example of that, as are our infrastructure investment plan, inward investment plan, and construction recovery plan. And at that macro level, we actually have the technologies, we have the solutions in place, and in many cases we have the capability. But what we don't yet have are accepted models of procurement that are driven by outcomes rather than that economic value. And I think what we see when those outcomes are aligned to socioeconomic, environmental factors, we can really drive real value for our citizens. But consumers do ultimately remain largely influenced by cost. In my day job, we look right across the built environment and the construction industry. And what we see is that buildings and construction activity are responsible for around 40% of global CO2 emissions. What that looks like, there's about 28% in what we would term operational emissions. So that's things like heating and lighting, general energy. And about 11% of that is in embodied or upfront emissions. So that's the materials that are used to carry out that construction activity. So really the point in that is that consumers have an absolutely critical role to play here. And what we're really talking about is not so much a technical challenge, but it's absolutely an attitudinal, behavioural and cultural challenge that requires us all to work together and really visualise what that kind of cleaner, safer, more prosperous future looks like. And from a consumer perspective, this means being more accepting of just basic things like repurposed materials and assets, recognising the impact of construction activity on our environment, And of course, the having a big focus on decarbonising our heating energy, which is great for consumers, will absolutely play a significant role in reducing fuel poverty. The last point that I'll make is that the concern that I have relates to the rise of businesses who are greenwashing through the net zero carbon agenda by making claims that they can't always meaningfully substantiate. And whilst I remain optimistic that change will come, I do recognise the value associated with being on brand, and similarly, they recognise the power that brand and brand messaging has over consumer behaviour. So, I guess in summary, what I would call for is consumers to really reflect on what they consume, how they consume it, how they measure and interpret value, and really consider their role as global citizens rather than as individuals.
Now, thank you very much for that, Douglas. And it's really interesting you mentioned the role of the consumer here. I want to bring in Gerald, because Gerald, we've had many discussions in the past about why it's taking so long to implement better and effective policy. Would you agree with Douglas it's on the consumer, or would you actually say there's other factors that are playing over here?
Well, I was having a good think about this week, and I think one of the traps with us, because we're all in it, it's part of our life. We smell it, we think it, we breathe it, we eat it. We just want to do something about it. So we're all very well skilled up on it. But the average consumer, they go down a shop and they stare at this product, or they go and see a man that is selling a product, right? They always sell a product. And the first thing they hear is it's efficient, it's the best, it's the latest. They can't sort of relate to what that all means, where I would say if someone says to me, I'm looking at, for example, something that heats my home, and I go and they say, this is very efficient. With my background, I'd say, how or why? The average person would just stare at it and go, he would listen to that person. And that often that person is a person that is selling a product with a profit in it for him. So he has to sell it well. And I'm still quite amazed in actually 2020, all of us as experts and areas, yes, we're all very passionate. We talk about things like CO2 and kilograms per this and kilowatts per this, and we all understand it, but the average consumer, who is an intelligent person because they're alive, they have an impact on our world, they struggle to relate to what we all are saying. So all this talk of CO2 tons in air and atmosphere and kilowatts on actual power used, and it goes on and on and on. We had a bit of an example in the last maybe 4 or 5 years where we would rate the efficiency we would rate on a actual product, something like a house, a actual fridge, right? And we go, it's got an energy rating of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And it was pretty successful, but it wasn't spelled out properly. And actual people would go, if it's down there, it's not that good. If it's up there, it's good. And it was sort of reflect the cost of it. So it actually didn't work. I think what we've got to do more of is with even at schools and kids, if they're starting young in life, we just need something like a simple 0 to 10 scale. And we go, if you see something with a 0, it's bad, and if you see something with a 10, it's good. And we can start to teach them from basics, but being more efficient doesn't have to cost more. At the moment, we have an attitude where we say, if you want efficiency, you're going to pay more. You're going to pay a lot more. It's not quite true, and I hope we get through it and we can talk that out, because I've got some examples that that we can have talk through as we go along. So, yes, I agree.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for that, Gerald. I think you're making a lot of great points. And I think that's an interesting perspective, having like a grading scale, you know?
Yeah, I find it very hard for, yeah, because when we start to talk, the average person goes, oh, wow. Oh, yeah. Okay. And yeah. They feel sort of, they feel a bit uneasy because they should know more, but we have to make it easy for them. And we have to start this with, we have to start this with kids, and we have to bring it through. And if they absolutely have a flair in it, they are, you're off and away with
it. Salma Bize, I wanted to bring you in and hear your thoughts on why it is taking so long for better and more effective policy.
Yeah, sure, I can do that. I think what we're discussing is really, really important. I think what we've missed in the past is really, when we're putting together policy, it's really important that we bring together multiple stakeholders, because at the end of the day, these multiple stakeholders will be impacted by this policy, and they're the ones that have to take ownership and deliver on these policies. So they have to be part of the policymaking process, and to buy into this policy change. Most of the time, you know, policymakers are removed also from the real issues, and data is really fantastic, and is really, really important. But also real life experiences are critical in the policymaking space. There needs to be a transformation in the challenges that plague, you know, achieving policy change. And some bottlenecks that we keep picking up over and over again is the lack of sound administrative and managerial capabilities. You know, we all talk about bureaucratic bottlenecks, political uncertainty, and this delays the finalization and the critiquing of existing policy and how we, in fact, improve policies, and also causes unexpected alterations in policies that in itself creates red tape most of the time. In Africa's case specifically, it's also some challenges include insufficient data to inform good policy making decisions. The other challenge is also things like key beneficiaries, you know, private sector, philanthropists, citizens themselves who are not involved in how we're implementing these policies, and you know, and that also just causes, again, a lack of collective action. You know, what we do at Global Citizen is that we try to work with an entire ecosystem to catalyze synergies between relevant stakeholders, be it private sector, be it civil society, public sector, philanthropists, world leaders, influencers, artists, ordinary citizens, to galvanize around an issue, to care about an issue, and then to take action. It must also be stated that making policy, you know, is only part of the battle to drive real change. Policies must be efficient. They must be effective. They must have proper governance in place. However, the action itself around the policies is also equally critical. The human behavior around the policies is also equally critical.
Yeah, thank you for that, Salma Bize. I absolutely agree. You know, multiple stakeholders need to be present, but also active for, you know, effective policy to be implemented. Rami, what are your thoughts?
No, it's absolutely fascinating. I mean, look, the question is, why is it taking so long to implement? And it's clear, it's complex. We have, as Douglas mentioned, the consumer. Gerald was talking a lot about standards and about the role of price and role of the company. And then Salma Bize is also talking about data, but also the individual, and then also regulation and good governance. So it is very, very complex. And I think we're really opening up some of the challenges we're going to face, because consumerism, it's easy to say, let's put policy in place, but doing it is going to be much harder. Gerald, I want to come back to you on a couple of things. First, I want to start with, you talked about, you know, we need to have these better, these rating scales and better That for me is all about standards. It's about the implementation of good, strong, and clear standards. We've seen it in different countries. France, for example, is now putting in more laws in around food waste, you know, about repairability of electronics. Can you give a bit of insight into, you know, the standards and how complex it is to get the right standards, Gerald?
Well, Australian standards in Australia, in our area, in this country, there's about 3,500 Australian standards. So the laws are there, right? The standards are there. But they're very focused on we'll say risk and the ash performance, right? When you add the environmental twist to it, which has been happening for the last 8, 9, 10 years, I'd have to say they've been working hard. So let's clear up and say the Australian standards for actual construction are incredible here. They're very strong. They're very good. And we can generally audit stuff coming in and out to Australia, and we have standards that stop. We have standards that stop, you know, junk coming in, or we have standards for most things. But we have a system to monitor waste. And I'm not sure it's a standard yet or it's an applied standard, but it's a system that's audited. And in Australia, we have EPA, and we have, around the world, we have a couple of large auditing style actual businesses that audit something for its waste and its you know, fit and all these things. And I don't know if I should mention their names, but there are two large companies. Well, for the last 20 years, we've had watchdogs in suits, and they're getting paid quite a lot. And I sort of left it and I thought, wow, is this, so even if we have the policy, because we have policies here in Oz, but then you get the corporations that bend it and twist it and slide it and move it, and they have these great ways of doing it.
Yeah, so, I mean, it makes me think it's like, who is watching the watchdogs? Who is regulating the regulators?
I see the watchdog, but I don't see them with teeth.
Yeah.
I don't see them with teeth. Now, maybe they can say it's a policy problem, but they also have a responsibility to affect the policy from their experiences, because they're in the world awarding stars.
Yeah.
And that's not right.
Exactly.
That's not right.
I'm sure, Douglas, you must have lots of common experience to share with Gerald, just talking about activating policy and putting it into place. Douglas, can you talk us through your experience with Scotland's construction recovery plan and the circular economy bill?
Yeah, certainly. And if you don't mind, just if I could make a brief comment on Gerald's contribution.
Please do.
Yeah, so I mean, I really support many of the messages that Gerald has been sharing with us. I think we have a habit in construction of consistently building unique structures. And this really is a primary cost of waste. We over-engineer, we don't share lessons, mistakes, and many of our components change specification from job to job. And we can demonstrate that over 10% of waste is actually generated in the design phase, which is, you know, completely avoidable. So we're pushing hard on the concept of design for manufacturing and assembly, disassembly. And what this means is that we can reuse the materials and components that make up a building at the end of that building's lifespan. And you know, this is really about standardizing designs and components. And, you know, Gerald's earlier comments around rating systems to make it very clear around the embodied and operational carbon within these components is really important. And you know, what that doesn't mean is that everything looks the same But what it does mean is that everything is made from, you know, from a more limited set range of components, which are rated for high performance, and which, you know, which are designed to optimized waste reduction. So I think, you know, these are really important considerations and very much in support of Gerald's earlier contribution. So if I can answer the question around policy development. So in Scotland, we declared a national climate emergency in 2019. We're one of the first nations to do so. And we also have a government net zero pledge, which currently sits at 2045, but which we fully expect to come closer. And so what we have is, you know, we have a policy framework, which, you know, which ultimately begins with a national performance framework aligned to the Sustainable Development Goals. And this has been really important for us as a nation, because what we're effectively saying is that, you know, we are going to look to address local, regional, national you know, challenges and opportunities in a way that really connects in with that, you know, with that global mindset, with the global philosophy that comes from the goals. And so, you know, we could work through all of the policies, acts and bills, but what I thought I would do is just pick out, you know, three specific examples and then really hone in on one. So, you know, this year, in response to COVID, we introduced a green recovery plan, which took us, you know, the title was Towards a Robust, Resilient, Wellbeing Economy for Scotland. And that plan was led by a prominent industry representative, Benny Higgins. And what it really focuses on is an industry-led recovery. So very much about industry working hand in hand with government, a regionally focused recovery, but a recovery that was underpinned by streamlined planning and, you know, strong regulation around around that, you know, that green, the inclusive and sustainable growth agenda. We do have a Climate Change Act, which came into play in 2019, and that's been supplemented by a circular economy bill, which is it's still been worked on, and which hasn't yet had the emphasis on construction activity that I would certainly like to see. But what we also have this year, and in fact just, you know, just in the last couple of months, is the emergence of a construction recovery plan. And this is a plan that sets out, you know, the green recovery for the construction industry and for our built environment. And so what I'm really presenting here is a story of deep and integrated alignment from global to national policy, from national to regional, local and sectoral policies. And I would say that it's the first time in my career, certainly, that industry leaders in government have worked collaboratively in this way. Of course, COVID has been a significant driver in the early stages, but it's really morphed into a programme of activity that has a far longer horizon. And, you know, so what we've been experiencing, you know, over the last, certainly in 2020, is the formation of a National Construction Leadership Forum. And that's a forum which, you know, which is made up of representatives of industry, government, public sector, academics and relevant experts. And as I mentioned in the early stages, it was about survival. You know, our construction sites were closed, and, you know, innovation loves a crisis, and, you know, COVID has certainly provided us with that. But, you know, what we've seen is a recognition that, you know, when all these people are in the same room, you know, talking about the same things with the same ambitions, you know, the emphasis, you know, of, you know, of collaboration, the emphasis on, you know, trying to get an industry to get back to work, to, you know, to be able to carry out its core function, you know, has absolutely been a catalyst to, you know, to really explore what these positive shifts might look like. And so, you know, the conversations that we're having now, and which, you know, which ultimately have been incorporated into a plan for the sector, they are holistic in nature. So they look at, you know, our commercial and pipeline activity. They look at supply chain resilience and capability. They look at our skills and our workforce. They look at data and insight. So, you know, again, you know, what role does data have in supporting a green recovery? And I suppose most importantly of all, they look at transformation and, you know, what a better, more prosperous construction industry in Scotland looks like. So, As I say, that has been a collaboration that's been going on over the last few months. It's resulted in an action plan. We have 83 actions, which I won't go through. But we have actions relating to net zero, to offsite modular construction, to digital transformation, and to reshoring the supply chain with a real focus on indigenous materials. And so what we have in Scotland for the first time is at a real micro level is an industry recovery plan, which is laser focused on green recovery. It's laser focused on, redefining construction in Scotland and in the UK. But, whilst that exists at the micro level, at the macro level, everything that we are doing is really feeding up into that global agenda led by the Sustainable Development Goals.
Oh, well, thank you for that, Douglas, giving our listeners some insight in what's going on in Scotland. Rami, your thoughts?
No, I just think it's good to see policy in action. Gerald talks about accountability, imploring us to think about who is exactly doing regulating and how we get these watchdogs to be more accountable. It also relates to what Douglas has been talking about, getting the academics and policymakers on the same table so that the right solutions can be made. I now want to move to the other end of the spectrum, the individual. So, Nabise, in terms of the actual role the individual can play, do you actually think the policy can ever be truly inclusive, or is it always going to be dominated by the lead number of people, which at the end of the day, therefore, leaves the individual out of the discussion?
For me, policy change, that is ensuring sustainable high growth must be inclusive, both in the process of formulating, but also in the process of implementing the actual policy. Equity and inclusiveness underpin any growth strategy that is intended to not leave anyone behind. In other words, that is intended to benefit citizens. That being said, I don't think it can be denied that political elites do exist and play a leading role in policymaking and influencing the shaping of policy outputs just by virtue of their access to political information, their positions, their networks, and in some cases, affordability and resources. But I think this is, however, what necessitates active citizenship at an individual level, recognizing the incredible potential for influence over public policy making if individuals actually play a role. So yesterday, I joined the Africa Youth SDGs Summit, where we were speaking on this topic around elitism in policy. And one of the examples I made when there isn't inclusivity within policymaking is that in some African countries today, condoms are distributed for free and reproduction is a choice. But menstrual health is not a choice for women. It's a natural process that women go through at a certain age. And yet we don't have a free distribution of sanitation pads. And that is a result of not enough diversity and inclusion within the policymaking process. And there's many examples that we could make that show the lack of inclusion in some cases when policy is being made. And the process, I think, should really be transparent, evidence-based, accessible, and responsive to as wide a range of citizens as possible. I think it is incumbent upon us as policymakers, is incumbent upon governments to ensure that the process includes agencies like civil society, individuals, the actual citizens themselves, and not just the elite or people who have access to policymakers, in order for accountability to also be a process that can be included in the policymaking. I think inclusive policymaking enhances all these elements: transparency, accountability, public participation, and just building civic capacity. It also offers a way for governments to improve their policy performance when they have working citizens and active citizens and active civil society and active communities. It really improves the policy performance in itself.
Yeah, these are great points, especially creating inclusion for citizens. I want to go to Gerald. Gerald, sometimes it is evident that the private sector plays a big role in the implementation of policy. So could you share some examples from your journey where you have seen this challenge between the public and private sectors?
An example is solar. Example is wind. Australia was doing that 12 years back. So I stare at what's going on now and I go, oh, yeah, brother, okay, fine. But the world of energy picked it up and now it's just this mad rave. But, you know, South Australia was one of the first places on the planet to do solar at large scale. We were the first silly little state that did an actual battery. And they all laughed at us. They all thought we were crazy. They actually punished us. You know, the big oil companies and the gas companies and the governments, even the governments actually jumped in and they hammered us. But it's quite amazing now because we don't even stand up and brag about it, but we're just well and truly actually down the road and all the policy has fitted in around this point of lead. And it's quite amazing watching what's going on right throughout the whole, you know, throughout the whole Western world. When we were playing with solar, you know, a long time back, and we were getting criticised, but then the policy kicked in and off it went. So yeah,
Gerald, thanks for that and a great point, which takes me to Douglas. Douglas, you work in an industry that is dominated by so many big private sector players, and many ways considered one of the most unethical industries. People who don't want change, people who are lobbying under the radar in construction. And construction is tied to energy. It's tied to people. It's tied to materials. It's tied to mining. It's tied to so many other industries. Douglas, from your perspective and what you've seen, how important is the private sector? How influential is it? And how do we move the private sector to play the role that it needs to play? Yes, it does provide jobs. Yes, it's about profitability. Yes, it's about creating economic growth. But how do you also get them to push the sustainable agenda at the same time?
Yeah, okay. So it's a wonderful question. If only I had the definitive answer. I mean, what I would say is that, you know, in Scotland, we're certainly fortunate to have a wealth of natural assets. So wind power is, you know, we've seen a huge uptake in the generation of renewable energies in general, actually. But what we also have is an economy that has traditionally been underpinned by oil and gas. And as you mentioned, you know, we have a large number of very influential multinationals who are keen on influencing our national policy. But that being said, you know, within the construction context, we have an industry that's made up, you know, about 98% of our industry in Scotland within the construction context are actually small, mid-sized and micro businesses. And so what we have is, you know, a very strong industry voice that represents or is representative of larger contractors. And then a huge number of smaller and micro businesses who are represented through trade associations and professional bodies. And I think what we've been doing over the last 6 months, and I've referenced the Construction Leadership Forum. We also have another forum that's entitled the CICV Forum, which is made up of those trade associations and professional bodies. And what we're seeing is, you know, this collective voice emerging, this truly representative voice emerging that, you know, captures the, you know, the challenges and opportunities at, you know, the small micro business owner level, but equally considers the, you know, the role that these big businesses play. I would say that, you know, the kind of changes in behaviour largely are being driven by policy without doubt, and that's been really helpful. But what we've also seen is a real shift being driven by investor behaviour. And investors undoubtedly are, you know, becoming more focused on low carbon. They're becoming more focused on net zero. They recognise, you know, the long term, you know, return on investment that these approaches bring. And what the construction industry has always been very good at doing is responding to demand. So quite simply, if a pipeline of work can be demonstrated and communicated, the industry will respond. And so that combination of strong government policy, very clear investor changes in investor behaviour, and being in a fortunate position where many of the tools, processes, technologies are already in place to take us on that journey, create a perfect storm in which we can make progress. The last point that I would make is that we're incredibly fortunate to have a really strong tertiary education sector. So we have over 40 colleges and universities to serve as a population of 5.5 million people. And many of those universities actually feature top 100 global rankings. So we have a large national investment in research and development. And whilst the industry, construction industry investment in that area has traditionally been low, we are seeing industry and government coming together to collaboratively invest in R&D activity, which helps to push the net zero agenda forward. And that's very much where Construction Scotland Innovation Centre sits, and where we're able to add value.
No, that's fantastic. And it's really positive to hear that there are strides being made forward and we are seeing industry working with government. But I also really liked your point about what you said about tertiary education. I think sometimes we forget, and it's easy to talk about policy, think of it at the highest level, but education plays such an important role in enabling us as individuals to really be part of that discussion and understand and then influence what we do in our companies and our governments and our day-to-day roles. Ben, that kind of something we've both talked about a lot, right, Ben?
Yes, indeed, my friend. Speaking on Douglas's point about smaller businesses, clearly we need to step up our agency as individuals. Salma Bize, what is Global Citizen doing to help citizens drive and change policy to be more representative and inclusive?
Yeah, so Global Citizen, I think I had indicated earlier as well, we believe in the power of movements, that we believe that individuals are a powerful driving force in transformational change. And our work is really centered around mobilizing action takers, policymakers towards necessary reforms for society at large. We the way in which even our organization is structured is that we're a movement of engaged citizens who and we use our collective voice, as indicated earlier, to end extreme poverty by 2030. We've learned that the systematic causes of extreme poverty are largely things that humans themselves, and with every citizen being active, that can erode. And we, some of the things that we do and encourage citizens to participate and to be active is we prepare action. So we would identify a policy issue within the Sustainable Development Goals. Within them, we focus on three thematic areas. So we focus on human capital development, which is SDGs 1, 2, and 3. We focus on equity and inclusion, which is around gender equality, SDG 5, SDG 8, and then as well as cleaner planets, which is above water, below sea, and sustainable cities. And so when we encourage citizens to participate in the implementation of the SDGs, we ask them to sign petitions, which we then hand over to governments to say, a large pool of your citizens actually has identified this issue and they think you could solve it by changing a policy or implementing a policy that is already in place. If it's not a petition, sometimes we have direct conversations. We send emails. We attend rallies. To date, we have about 880 million lives that we have impacted through these actions. And this is, the impact is financial commitments, but also significant policy change across the SDGs. I think the agency of individuals cannot be underestimated. And One of the examples I had made earlier, and which I can talk you through, is the Mandela 100 campaign, which we launched in, we held in South Africa in December 2018 in commemoration of President Mandela, former President Mandela, the late former President Mandela. We brought together, you know, the largest contingency of heads of states. We had dignitaries. We had a group of the world's most talented artists and influencers. About 70,000 global citizens were present at the stadium where we had the event. And it was really a profound and impactful event in the world to date. In the lead up, I think Global Citizens took about 5.2 million actions in Southern Africa alone. We had 16 governments, we had 8 international institutions, we had foundations and 12 corporates who made financial and political commitments. We saw over $7.2 billion of commitments being raised by both corporates as well as governments. And then, you know, now this year, because of COVID-19, we pivoted because largely we would activate things physically, but because of COVID-19 and the restrictions that we had, we pivoted to virtual experiences. This year we've held two very big significant ones. One was One World Together at Home, which we held in April together with the United Nations, and the purpose for that one was really to support frontline workers. And then the second one was Global Goal Unite for Our Future, which we held in June. And the purpose for that one was to raise funds for tests, treatments, and vaccines, but also to advocate for equitable access once, you know, for tests, treatments, and once the vaccine is developed. And now we're in a process of really getting partnering. Currently, one of our biggest campaigns, two of them, one was the Vote campaign, which we worked with artists, we worked with leaders in the US to get as many people to vote as possible. Then the other one was is currently on our plates is working towards funding and pledges for the Act Accelerator, because you can imagine how much money it's going to take and how much commitment it's going to take to develop the vaccine, but also the distribution of the vaccine. And so we're doing a lot of lobbying from world leaders to citizens themselves to say, advocate for equitable access. Let's ensure that everyone, once a vaccine is developed, has access to the vaccine and not just the elite. What we've done also really advocated for, instance, the AU chair and the president of South Africa, President Cyril Ramaphosa, has been such a big supporter of some of our initiatives around the Act Accelerator. He's currently the co-chair, credit be to the Department of International Relations. He's the co-chair of the Act Accelerator. And those kind of active citizen and participation from everyone in society is really what has enabled most of our campaigns and to be as effective as they are to date.
Well, Salma Bize, thank you so much for giving us insight into what's going on with the Global Citizen. It's really, really inspiring. Rami, your thoughts, my friend.
No, it's great. And I think it's organizations like Global Citizen that will help individuals realize that they have a voice. And as both Douglas and Gerald also said, listen, we need to get everybody involved. We need to get people. Gerald mentioned it. People want change now. People want to see a difference. It's no longer that we as the average consumer want to see bad products. We're asking better questions.
We would like to take this opportunity to give a shout out to our official partner for the season, BankU, a for-profit, for-purpose company that is bringing transparency to our supply chains. Here is a quick word from the founder and CEO, Ashish Gadnis.
Policies and regulations have to be integrated with real-world supply chain flows. Otherwise, they're absolutely ineffective. Silo solutions or silo policies don't work. Opening a school near a mine won't alone end child labor. At Bank U, we believe that education, access to clean water and sanitation, gender equality, biodiversity are all key elements of a strong ecosystem in the last mile that needs strong policy and regulation supporting them.
And look, it's been an absolutely fantastic conversation. We're coming towards the end of it now, and there's still so much to go, and I wish we had more time. But before we close up, I wanted to just put a quick question out and get a very, very quick and brief answer from all three speakers. We're going to start with Douglas. What would you like to see change so that we can establish policies that have the best interest of society, the environment, and the economy altogether? I know it's a big question, and I'm asking for a short answer, but if you can, that'd be fantastic. Let's go with you, Douglas, first.
Yeah, certainly. So, for me, there's three things that I would like to see. The first of which is to see the expansion of a citizens' assembly to ensure that citizens are genuinely engaged in policy development, policy decisions, and to ensure a better degree of representation across our policy development space. I'd like to see us continue to place industry and government partnership at the heart of regulation and reform, but also to support that culture of collaborative investment, and perhaps more importantly, the sharing of these value metrics that we've been discussing throughout the show. And lastly, I'd really like to see us getting back on track with the essence and spirit of the Paris Agreement. Let's come together in Glasgow in 2021 at COP26 and really push further beyond those ambitions agreed in Paris and bring our net zero horizon a little bit closer to benefit us all.
Great points. I would add to Douglas's first point and say I would actually like to see citizens hold everywhere around the world, hold each other accountable, especially as far as voting goes. Like, check on your neighbor, check on your cousin, check on your uncle. Have you voted? Let's ask Soma Bize, what would you like to see change? Like, what are some points that you would like to see raised?
Yeah, I think I completely agree. I completely agree with the points that have already been raised. I think I'd like to add, for me, I'd really like policy to the policy makers, the policy decision makers to drive a little more diversity and inclusion. We see about $1 trillion loss because of a lack of diversity and inclusion when it comes to policymaking as a globe. And I think that money could be used to drive sustainable development goals. It could be used to achieve the global goals if we just expanded the table or we just drove policy decisions that were diverse and inclusive of everyone in society. And that to do that, we all have to be engaged and participating.
Thank you very much, Amabizia. That was fantastic and powerful, like everything you've said today. Last but not least, Gerald, what would you like to see change so we can get and establish the policies that we need?
I would think the one thing that I would like to see change would be to have the policy address the amount of emissions. We talk about efficiencies, we talk about carbon, we talk about CO2 and all those things, but there's a lot of emissions of waste. We need to get some standards put in place with policy to say we want to set some very strict Wassail guidelines, and you will work at that. Everyone's having a shot, everyone's sort of arguing, but to get in control of this whole planet and the amount of waste going on, we have to decide in policy what are the biggest drivers. It's not efficiency of plant, because efficiency of plant hasn't worked. It's not the cost of plant. It's not the speed that we build it. It's the impact of the plant on this planet. And I think the policies must focus in there and say, we want an emission standard at X. We don't care how you do it. Better be efficient at it. it has to address it really quickly to start to control so much of the hidden waste that's going on, the visible waste, but really deal and start there.
Thanks for that, Gerald. The whole objective of this episode was to explore and discuss the role of policy and managing consumerism. I think we achieved that today. What do you think, Rami?
No, absolutely. And what a great episode we did today. And our guests really showed us the different aspects of policymaking. I guess if we start and we summarize what we discussed today, while policy can limit, say, greenhouse gases, it cannot be restricted to the technical challenge. There must be carrots for good behavior and culture, and taxes, fines, and reputational damage for the rest. Corporates, entrepreneurs, and individuals must think of their role as global citizens and stop constantly trying to circumvent the rules. Another point to think about is standardization and automation. They can definitely help bring efficient use and reuse of materials, energy, and labor as long as they don't kill creativity. Policy must balance that. Policy is also the backbone of enabling equitability. It can insist on quotas and targets while there is still a problem, and then remove them when it's solved. But policymaking must be collaborative. Top-down ideas need to meet bottom-up needs and aspirations. Globally, whether you are in Scotland, South America, Australia, or anywhere in between, it is SMEs that drive our economy, so governments and multinationals need to hear them. Yes, there will be cases where policy is behind, as in the rollout of solar power in Australia, but generally it must be a step ahead. Global temperatures have already risen by more than 1 degree Celsius, above pre-industrial levels. Given the damage we're already responsible for, policy needs to be far more radical. There is increasing investor focus on net zero, and that is good. That's what we need. Finally, activists must keep policymakers honest. So I do think we've covered a lot today, Ben, and I'm really glad that we have this episode. In the next one, episode 5, we're going to be talking about the circular economy and how we can shift from linear to the circular. I'm super excited, and thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in today. I'm one of your co-hosts, Rami Samaria, founder of The Oblique Life, signing out.
And I'm the other half, Ben Joseph. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you once again for listening to the Oblique Life Global Goals podcast. If you enjoyed today's session, please do like, follow, and share it with your friends, family, and colleagues.
That's right. We need to discuss these topics and share solutions. So as Rami said, please do follow us, like our episodes, but also share any questions or comments you have, and we will get back to you.
We want to spark discussion and want all of you to be part of it. From The Oblique Life and all of our partners, thanks for tuning in, and hope to have you join in our next episode.